Good evening. It is just a little after 6 p.m. here on WEFT Champagne 90.1 FM Radio. This is the program where we are at. Just to let you know that the views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speaker and not necessarily represent those of WEFT Champagne, Prairie Air Incorporated, Station Management, the Board of Directors, or the WEFT Associates. As I said, this is where the program where we're at. My name is Ben. Today's date is November 10th, 2025. That tune you just heard was Cold, Cold Winter Night by Eddie Raspberry from the album Authentic Mississippi Delta Urban Blues. Eddie Raspberry, Big Daddy Robert Robinson, and Melvin Smokehouse Moore were the some of the artists or guitarists, musicians there on that album. Just speaking of winter night, even though we don't usually get snow this early, as far as I can remember here in this part of East Central Illinois, but I did, since this is such a, I did want to do a little quick weather forecast report, since given the snow that we've had last night and this morning. It is currently 31 degrees. I do believe it will get down like last night, where I believe it reached into the 20s. Sorry, having a little technical issues with the it's going to get down to, 27, 25, 23 tonight. And then I'm trying to look at the forecast for next week. And then it'll get up into tomorrow morning. It'll be about 26 degrees as you get ready for work or class or whatever it is that you do tomorrow, your morning schedule. Get up into 30s, 37, looks like it'll get up to 43 tomorrow in the 3 p.m., 4 p.m. Then it'll drop down, but it won't be as cold as it'll be about 38, 39 tomorrow night. And I don't believe we're expected to get any more snow this week. In fact, it will actually, the highs anyways, could get up until the 60s on Thursday and Friday, 69 on Friday, according to the current forecast. Might even get up until the 70s on Saturday, the 15th. So, kind of a strange sort of, if you would call it, bipolar weather. But that's just the look at your current forecast. I did want to do a kind of update on what's going on in Washington, D.C., where the Senate took a series of votes to reopen the government, which means that this will go most likely go back to the House. This is according to what I'm reading on CNN's website. The Senate has begun a series of votes that will end with a final vote to pass a compromise funding package to reopen the government. If approved, the House will have to return and adopt the deal before it is sent to President Donald Trump's desk to be signed. Currently, the President Trump said that he supports the Senate federal funding deal to reopen the government in exchange for a future vote on extending enhanced affordable care subsidies. An appeals court rejected the Trump's administration's effort to block fully paying food stamp benefits in November, but many recipients are still in limbo. Meanwhile, more staffing issues are being reported at airports after the worst weekend for air traffic control staffing, I believe, since the start of the shutdown. This has been the longest government shutdown in the country's history. In fact, more speaking on the issue of what's been going on with air traffic control staffing. This is from CNN that was published this morning. On their website, more air traffic control staffing problems were reported this weekend. This weekend than any other weekend since the start of the shutdown, according to a CNN analysis of Federal Aviation Administration operations plans. There were 146 traffic triggers reported from Friday morning to Sunday night, which means air traffic controllers had to alter operations to keep the airspace safe with fewer people working. These steps can include rerouting planes or delaying flights when there are not enough controllers to handle the normal workload. 32 of the staffing problems were reported Friday, 63 Saturday, and 51 on Sunday. Since the start of the shutdown, there have been 596 reports of short staffing causing a trigger, more than six times as many as were reported on the same dates last year. Remember, the worst weekend for air traffic controller staffing was the weekend of Halloween, when there were 98 staffing triggers, 46 reported on October on October 31st alone. So yes, right now with the current shutdown, I believe most of eight Democrats voted in favor of the of ending the shutdown, which would then which they thought would have a vote guarantee a vote on expiring enhanced Obamacare subsidies once the House is back in session. But now Speaker Mike Johnson is saying that is not guaranteed to happen, to have a vote on expiring affordable subsidies on the Affordable Care Act, to reopen the, in exchange for a future vote on extending enhanced affordable care subsidies. I believe they're hoping for the House to vote to have the reopen the government by Wednesday. But we shall see. And I believe Tim Kaine, who was the Virginia senator and the VP nominee for Hillary Clinton back in 2016. Angus King, independent senator of Maine, was also one of the eight senators who voted for it. But that is what has been going on in Washington, D.C. with the current news. We'll see what happens if the House does vote on this. As soon as they do, I will probably talk more about this next week. I should be here next week with Illinois 13th congressional Democratic candidate for Illinois 13th congressional district, Dylan Blaha, who I plan on who should be in the studio with me here live on WEFT next week. That's the 17th. Dylan Blaha is a former veteran of the United States Army, where he served almost 13 years. He also worked as a biochemist for the University of Illinois. And he is one of the candidates, along with Emily Lux, who I interviewed on WEFT here a few weeks ago. Just a reminder, I believe the Illinois primary for the midterm elections, which you will hear a lot about on my on Breakthrough News, which I will play here in a little bit. But I still got a little things to do. But just for those who don't know, the Illinois primary for the 2026 midterms, I believe, if I can get the Illinois elections. Let's see if I can. I want to say it's March 17th is the date of the Illinois. I know that's a little far away. That's what, four months away. But you know, a lot of candidates have been collecting signatures to put their names on a ballot, like Emily Lux talked about. And just to let you know, if you would like to, WFT, we have a website for with all of our archived shows, and we'll check out all of our other shows, music shows, public affairs, news. All that can be found at weft.org. And if you just go to public affairs, and if you also would like to donate, we are a volunteer-run station. We really rely on our supporters, on our those who support us. If you could give us any money that you have left over, I know these are going to be tough times, obviously, with what's been going on. But we really do rely on our supporters, on our those who can give anything that they can, and we really do appreciate to our listeners, to our supporters for supporting us. You are the backbone of of WFT 90.1 FM. Let's see. I wanted to before I go any further, but again, yes, I will have on Dylan Blaha next week. Here live in the studio. It should be live November 17th. And again, if you will listen to us live, go to weft.org. We also have the WEFT app. If you go to Google Play Store or Apple Store, just search WEFT. You should be able to listen to us on. That's another way to listen to us on there. There's also some public service announcements or some other things that we like to broadcast or let people know about here on WFT. There is the Rose Bowl Tavern, and they're located in Urbana. They always have fun, great music, shows, bands. Sometimes they have trivia night on Wednesdays, jazz jam, a number of type of bands. If you want to know more, go to www.rosebowltavern.com. And if you have an old car, truck, motorcycle, or boat that you would like to get rid of, donate any old vehicle to Charitable Adult Rides and Services and designate WFT to receive the proceeds from your gift. All you need is a clear title. Charitable Adult Rides and Services will pick it up and haul it away with no charge to you. Make arrangements on the website at careasy.com or call 855-500-RIDE. That's 855-500-7433. Remember to tell them that you want WFT to receive the proceeds. And of course, if you would, if you're interested in hosting your own radio show like mine, or whether it be public affairs talk show, a music show, anything like that. There will be free training sessions on Sunday, November 16th. So that's this Sunday, November 16th at 3 p.m. at the WEF Studios. And we're located at 113 North Market Street in downtown Champaign. We're always looking for new talent. Anyone who's got an idea for a radio show, pretty open, as long as you abide by FCC guidelines, and you know you're motivated, whatever you have. Please, if you would like to host your own radio show, we will have a free training session Sunday, November 16th, here at the WEF Studios, 113 North Market Street in downtown Champaign, Sunday, November 16th, 3 p.m. Last thing before I get into my pre-recorded programming is the Champaign County Regional Planning Commission. They have a number of services and programs that I think are very worthwhile to know about, and if it's something that you may need, the Champaign County Regional Planning Commission, their website, ccrpc.org. They have what is called Low Income Home Energy Assistance Program, Homeless Prevention, Human Services Transportation, Homeless Prevention Rent Assistance, Safety, Lighting, Energy Efficiency Program, Senior Services, Transportation Assistance, Youth Assessment Center, and a number of, a lot of those very useful and helpful services and programs. Again, ccrpc.org is the website if you need it. For the Champaign County Regional Planning Commission, they are open normal business hours, Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. If you need a phone number, 217-328-3313. Their website, ccrpc.org. Okay, I am now going to throw it to Breakthrough News. They will talk about the elections from last week's elections. I got the audio program queued up and ready to go. Just a reminder that the views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speaker and don't necessarily represent those of WEFT Champaign, Prairie Air Incorporated, Station Management, the Board of Directors, or the WEFT Associates.
Breakthrough.
Welcome to Breakthrough Radio, the best of breakthrough news brought to you for 1 hour each week. I'm Sean Blackman. Now to our first story.
The APEC Leader Summit convened in South Korea last week. Meanwhile, Trump met with President Xi Jinping on the sidelines of the summit to negotiate a truce in the ongoing trade war. Who won this round of the trade war, and what does this mean for the new Cold War on China? We'll discuss this and more on this week's China Report. Welcome to the China Report. Every week, we'll be helping you sort through all the propaganda with an independent view of the country that we're taught to hate but know so little about. I'm your host, Amanda Yi. These are this week's headlines. China's Shenzhou 21 spaceship has launched and docked with the Tiangong space station in just 3.5 hours, setting a new record in the history of the country's crewed space missions. The Shenzhou 21 spaceship took off as planned at 11:44 p.m. local time last Friday from its launch center in northwestern China. The three crew members of the mission joined the Shenzhou 20 astronauts already aboard Tiangong, beginning their roughly six-month-long stay aboard the space station. The mission will include a range of science experiments spanning space life sciences and biotechnology, technology tests, fluid physics and microgravity, space medicine, space material science, and combustion. It will also include reproduction-related experiments with four mice, which also flew to Tiangong aboard the spacecraft. In its statements released about the mission, Beijing has emphasized Shenzhou 21 as a symbol of a nation that pursues balance, reason, and cooperation. According to Chinese media, quote, China firmly believes that space belongs to all humanity, not to any single nation or military bloc. The purpose of space exploration is to advance knowledge and technology, not to create new grounds for confrontation, unquote. China pitched greater integration among countries in the region to defeat growing protectionism and instability during the 47th ASEAN summit. The summit was held from October 26th to 28th in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, and the meeting focused on strengthening cooperation among its member states. During the summit, China and ASEAN upgraded their existing free trade agreement to cover new areas such as digital trade, the green economy, sustainability, and support for small and medium-sized enterprises. ASEAN remains the largest trading partner of China, with trade totaling $1 trillion in 2024. In his address to the summit, Chinese Premier Li Qiang emphasized the greater need to implement President Xi Jinping's Global Governance Initiative, or GGI. He argued that the GGI was necessary to face the growing challenges in international politics. The GGI is a diplomatic initiative presented by Xi at this year's Shanghai Cooperation Organization Summit in September. Its five core concepts are staying committed to sovereign equality, to international rule of law, to multilateralism, to the people-centered approach, and to real results. Li stated, quote, China will work with all parties to ensure that this mission is observed and take vigorous actions to promote the GGI to boost peace and development in our region, unquote. Beijing delivered over 44,000 three-way stopcocks intended for critically ill patients to the Cuban health system. The donation, supported by students and residents in China and expedited by Cuba's Committees for the Defense of the Revolution, was received this weekend and will be distributed to various healthcare centers by the Ministry of Public Health. The CDR emphasized the importance of the contribution, as stopcocks are essential in intensive care units and widely used for medical procedures such as IV therapy and anesthesia. Cuba faces critical shortages in not only life-saving medications and medical supplies, but also fuel, food, and other basic necessities due to the decades-long U.S. blockade and its ludicrous designation of the country as a state sponsor of terrorism. The pro-Israel lobby AIPAC now has its sights set on Taiwan. The American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, sent its first delegation to Taipei last Monday, October 27th. In his opening remarks at the AIPAC dinner, Taiwan's leader, William Lai Ching-te, stated that Israel was a so-called valuable model of defense for Taiwan. Lai is hoping for deeper collaboration with the U.S. and Israel in the areas of semiconductors, ICT, and cybersecurity, despite ongoing protests at home over the U.S.-Israel genocide in Gaza. Taiwan has maintained commercial ties with Tel Aviv since 1993 through an economic and trade office in Taipei. Donald Trump visited South Korea last week, meeting with both President Xi Jinping and President Lee Jae-myung. What are the agreements that came out of these two meetings, and what's next for the ongoing trade war, for the new Cold War on China? To discuss this, we are so pleased to have on Daehan Song. Daehan is part of the team at the International Strategy Center and also a member of the No Cold War Collective. He's based in Seoul. Daehan, welcome to the China Report.
Hello. Hi. Thank you for having me.
Well, we have a lot to talk about today, so I think we should get started. I want to start off with Trump's meeting with South Korean President Lee Jae-myung. What immediately jumped out at me about this agreement that came out of this was that South Korea will invest $350 billion in the U.S. as an exchange for Trump lowering his tariff rate on South Korea. And that includes $200 billion in cash, while the rest will go to cooperation in shipbuilding. The U.S. lags behind in this sector. South Korea is the second largest shipbuilder behind China, if I'm not mistaken. And this is an opportunity that the U.S. sees as a way to catch up to China. Also, as part of this agreement, Trump had given his approval for South Korea to build a nuclear-powered submarine. South Korea, obviously, a key ally in the U.S.'s military encirclement of China. So, you know, this all just seems like a huge extortion scheme to me. You know, hundreds of billions of dollars from South Korea going to the U.S. Walk us through these agreements and what do you make of all this?
Sure. I mean, it's complete tariff extortion, right? Like, I think oftentimes Lee's diplomacy was kind of applauded in South Korea for achieving, you know, going down from 25% to 15%. But I don't think like anybody realizes that there was a free trade agreement, right? Mm. The zero tariffs that were achieved, they were not like a giveaway to South Korea. They were achieved by like very difficult negotiation in which South Korea had to adopt a lot of toxic provisions from the United States, including the investor-state dispute settlement system. right? And just it is tariff extortion, right? Because it's like a $200 billion investment, but the United States gets to keep 50% of the profits, right? The U.S. is not putting any money forward, but it's taking 50% of profits. That's it's crazy. Not only is the Lee administration not investing in South Korea's economy, in creating jobs and in improving the lives of people in Korea, it's investing in the United States to make the U.S. military even more powerful and even more destructive. Like, that's insane, right? At a time of global warming, when we should be focusing our efforts in, you know, coming together as a global society and figuring out how to deal with climate change, like there's this massive military Keynesianism happening and South Korea is in effect, like helping the U.S. just maintain its military global dominance.
Mm-hmm. Well, Lee Jae-myung was elected earlier this year after Yoon Suk-yeol's impeachment. He ran on a platform of, you know, what he called resetting relations with China, which was seen as a bit of a departure from Yoon Suk-yeol's maybe like more enthusiastic participation in Washington's Cold War strategy. And from what I understand, Lee pitched the submarine deal with the U.S. as a way to help its Navy ships patrol waters near China and North Korea and, you know, lessen the burden on the U.S. military. And he also promised Trump during their meeting that they would increase military spending to counter China. So you've got this situation where Seoul is like very much intertwined with these military agreements with Washington, while economically still very interdependent with China. And I'm also thinking about how Beijing is a key ally to South Korea in trying to revive dialogue and revive relations with the North, with North Korea, which I believe was another point in Lee's campaign to get elected. But, you know, it's always the U.S. antagonizing the North, right? So I'm wondering, you know, how have you seen Lee's ability to balance pressure from the Trump administration while also trying to maintain or recalibrate relations with China? And is this balance of competing interests even possible in the long run?
Sure. When I think like compared to Yoon Suk-yeol, like Yoon Suk-yeol was just like a diehard, like pro-America, right? Like he was singing like American Pie. It's just kind of like making a fool of himself and basically said yes to everything that the United States asked for. I think in contrast, the Lee administration is a bit more pragmatic, right? It understands that we are seeing seismic shifts in the global order and that China is going to become a very important role in, you know, in the global order that is taking shape, right? So in that regard, I do think that there is a real interest in rebalancing. How it does that, I think that would be, it would be very interesting to see. You know, I think one of the interesting things was that while Lee Jae-myung is doing all these things around the military Keynesianism with Trump, on the other hand, I think there was like a summit or an exchange between like South Korea, Japan, and China around like renewable energy, right? So on the one hand, you have like Trump, who is a climate change denier. And on the other hand, like, I mean, South Korea acknowledges climate change and it acknowledges the need for renewable energy. So I could see how there's a certain rebalancing where it's going to try to keep certain things together with China, which China has like a certain vision around renewable energy, while at the same time trying to like, you know, do the things that that they're doing with Trump. So there is a certain rebalancing, but I also think that Lee is just playing a very dangerous game by giving in to many of Trump's demands to basically strengthen U.S. military.
Mm-hmm. Well, Trump met with South Korean President Lee Jae-myung. Of course, he also had another highly anticipated meeting with President Xi Jinping, which brought the two sides to a trade agreement after weeks of escalation. So as part of this agreement, Washington is agreeing to lower fentanyl tariffs from 20% to 10%. It's agreeing to suspend its 50% rule for its entities list, which resulted in something like 20,000 Chinese companies suddenly blacklisted under U.S. sanctions. And that was what had provoked Beijing to expand its rare earth controls in the first place. Washington is backing down from its 100% tariff threat, and it's also suspending shipport fees. In exchange, Beijing is rolling back its expanded rare earth restrictions for 1 year, suspending its shipport fees, cracking down on the export of chemicals used to produce fentanyl, and they also agreed to resume buying U.S. soybeans. So this is a truce agreement that will be revisited after a year. I'm just curious to know, you know, this was a really high stakes meeting. What's your analysis of this meeting and who won this battle during the trade war?
I think China totally won, you know, like, you know, in many regards, it's, you know, Trump was the one that fired the first shots. And then now he's like, I want a truce. And he just needed some like face-saving measures. And I think that's some of the things that China was willing to give him. In many regards, like China, even though China's trade with the United States was impacted, I think like China's GDP wasn't significantly impacted. You know, it just in some ways, China is like decoupling from the United States, right? China's trade like shifted to other countries like ASEAN countries, right? So in that regard, I think, you know, Trump tried to bully China and China didn't back down. And now Trump just needed a face-saving kind of way to like back down from it, right? And that's what they gave him, right? Mm.
Well, what's really funny to me is the showmanship of Trump around this trade war. And you can really see how he's a like this businessman, this reality TV show star, the way that he presents himself as attaining this win. After his meeting with Xi, just the way he was talking about this meeting, describing it as a 12 out of 10, hailing it as a success, him immediately posting to Truth Social that my G2 meeting with President Xi of China was a great one for both our countries, when even before the two sat down, mainstream media was already saying that China had won this trade war. And it just seems to me that this trade truce really brings us back to the status quo before Trump's Liberation Day, which maybe speaks to a few things, right? It speaks to, you know, despite the fact that, you know, Trump has all this bravado, it's really it speaks to the success of Beijing's tactic of escalating to force the other side to de-escalate, which maybe also speaks to the fact that Beijing has now emerged as an economic peer, one that's powerful enough to check Washington and put it in its place.
Sure. And not only that, like, Trump is like antagonizing all these countries, and basically China's like, hey, look, we're opposed to Trump's tariff war, right? And in that regard, it's becoming kind of like the only recourse for a lot of countries, right? So I think Trump's tariff war in many regards doesn't show the strength of the U.S. In fact, it shows its weakness, right? In the past, the U.S. had a certain kind of largesse that it could afford in its, you know, just in its overwhelming power. But now that it's becoming weaker, it's like it's not able to do so, right? Mm-hmm. And in many regards, this kind of like tariff war is just, it's just a way to like liquidate a lot of the goodwill that it tried to plant previously in order to maintain this kind of like a status as this like powerful superpower, right? And now that that's declining, they're just kind of like becoming a lot more stingy, right? A lot of more stingy extortionists. And yeah, so in many regards, I think Trump's tariff war is failing. And I think that's showing that it's accelerating kind of like the decline of the United States.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to turn to something that's probably somewhat pretty significant. It's that Pete Hegseth released this statement on X on Saturday, which states that after his own meeting with China's Minister of National Defense and Trump's historic meeting with Xi, Hegseth said, "We set the tone for everlasting peace and success for the U.S. and China. The Department of War will do the same. Peace through strength, mutual respect, and positive relations." China's Minister of National Defense, Admiral Dong Jun, in Malaysia and I also agreed that we should set up military-to-military channels to de-conflict and de-escalate any problems that arise. We have more meetings on that coming soon. God bless both China and the USA. So this messaging stands in pretty stark contrast both to the agreements that South Korea and the U.S. agreed to that we just discussed, but it also stands in contrast to Hegseth's own hawkish language in his address in front of the ASEAN foreign ministers last week, where he warned South Asian countries about what he saw as Beijing's aggressive actions in the South China Sea, and he urged them to stand firm in challenging China's presence in the sea. So what do you make of this Hegseth statement? And is it really indicative of a rebooting of U.S.-China relations?
I think that right now, basically the United States, I believe that it's like very much committed to this Cold War, a new Cold War that it's waging to contain China. So, yeah, I think a lot of these statements kind of just come and go, right? Like they might make a statement like this and then later something happens and it becomes a pretext for escalating things, or conversations can be happening behind the scenes regardless, right? So in that regard, I don't quite buy. Those are just words, right? Words have to be followed with actions. And I don't think the actions are seen yet. So, once actions start happening, then yeah, maybe it's something that, it should be something that's very welcome, but we have to see, but I don't buy it.
Mm. Well, Trump's visit to South Korea coincided with the APEC Leaders Summit, although he decided to skip it this year. Surely the people of South Korea can't be happy with Trump's shakedown of handing over hundreds of billions of dollars to the U.S. So how have the people responded to these latest developments? I know that there have been, some protests in the street against Trump, against APEC. I imagine that you've been following them. So can you talk a little bit about that and what are their demands?
Sure. Basically, we had there were a set of protests that happened on the 29th in Gyeongju when Trump was visiting. Trump came on the 29th and then he left on the 30th. And then there were also press conferences on the 31st. And then on the 1st, there was another protest and a rally and a march. And basically, we're talking about stopping Trump's trade extortionism, right? And there were also just demands against, more than just Trump's extortion, we oppose his sexism, we oppose his crackdown on immigrants, we oppose his warmongering, we oppose his military Keynesianism, his forcing countries to spend even more and more on the military when the world should be focusing more and more on how to develop and how to find peace, how to resolve climate change. These are the things that we opposed, right? And I think for us, we wanted to make a stand against Trump. Right. And so for us, there was a People's Declaration. And within the People's Declaration, we also called for another set of protests to happen globally on January 20th or on the first year anniversary of the Trump administration. So, yeah, ultimately for us, it was more than just APEC. Right. It was about the political moment that we're in. That might start with APEC, but it surely does not end there because, it's not just about trade that, it's not just trade that we're facing, right? Trade problems. We're also facing problems about war and existential ones like climate change, right? And none of this stuff is being discussed in APEC, right? And APEC meetings are happening all behind closed doors, right? They're discussing very important things like AI or aging populations, all these things, but none of it is open to the public. The media does a terrible job discussing any of this, any of the discussions that are happening. And, the people that are showing up are like NVIDIA, they're like Microsoft, they're like US power companies. And on these discussions that shape the future of the world.
For those that might not be familiar with APEC or what it is, I saw you give a really great presentation explaining exactly what APEC is for a Nota Dole panel maybe a week or two ago. So yeah, maybe for people who are unfamiliar, can you explain APEC and its mission?
Sure. APEC is the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Forum. And basically, it's a gathering that happens every year. And I think a lot of people think that it's just the leader summit, you know, the one that happened October 31st and November 1st. They think that that's all that it is. But in fact, it's a year-long process. It's a year-long consensus-building process. It's a trilateral meeting between businesses, businesses, governments, and experts slash academics, right? They're covering like all the issues that matter in society and the world, right? We're talking about renewable energy. We're talking about like how food security. We're talking about like how to overcome sexism or gender inequality, you know, AI, all these things. But like the public is not a part of these conversations at all. And nor are the elements of the conversation being disclosed to the public, right? So in fact, APEC almost becomes like a spectacle, right? All that the public sees is who is gonna come, and that G-Dragon is the APEC ambassador. You know, it's like people are given bread and circus while all these important decisions are happening behind closed doors. And yeah, I mean, that's one of the reasons why we were protesting. But ultimately, like APEC, its roots itself, it's like ultimately centered on corporations, on multinational corporations, and how to make it easier for them to extract greater profits. So, yeah, I mean, APEC ultimately makes all these important, has all these important discussions that impact everybody, but everybody's left out. And ultimately, its understanding of economic cooperation is like very limited, right? It just sees economy. It just sees corporations. It doesn't see like workers, farmers, just everybody and anybody that is affected by the economy and that makes the economy. We're all part of this economy, but economic cooperation here is like very narrowly defined to be the interests and needs of corporations.
Yeah, I think you also explained like something that was like called the flying duck strategy of APEC as a way of economic development. Could you explain that? Because I found it really interesting.
Sure. Originally, the idea of APEC, it emerged maybe kind of like the origins of the idea emerged in 1966 when a Japanese economist proposed a free trade area of the Asia Pacific. And basically during the 70s, 80s, Japan was creating these kind of like regional value chains. And in part, kind of like one of its justifications that it used was this notion of the flying geese, right? Mm. It was the notion that the leading goose, right, would mature, for example, Japan, would mature out of an economy and or out of an industry. And once it did that, it would pass it on to the next flying geese, right? Whether it's the newly industrialized countries like South Korea and Taiwan back then. And then when those countries kind of like mature out of this industry, it would pass it on to like Malaysia and Indonesia and whatnot. And of course, this is the Japan could say these things because Japan was the number two economy. I think a lot of us forget, right? But Japan was had massive growth, right? And in that regard, it kind of gained a certain level of a certain aura, right? As a country that succeeded in industrializing very rapidly and in having a lot of growth. So I think that's what was able to sell the idea. But this idea itself, like, dates back to like Japanese imperialism, right? It was an idea that was used to sell kind of like this Japanese imperialist notion of a greater society, like greater Asia prosperity community that was ultimately centered on Japan, right? On Japan's imperialist interests. And ultimately, this is how at the heart of like what APEC is kind of justified with this, right? It's the idea that if you make yourself friendly to corporations, you're going to get foreign direct investment.
Well, Daehan Song, thank you so much for joining us on the China Report. Maybe to end, could you let people know where people can find your work, if you're working on anything right now?
Sure. You could find us at goic.org. And also we have an Instagram page, which is goic. So you could check us out there.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Breakthrough.
We're going to take a quick break here on Breakthrough Radio, but we'll be right back.
Breakthrough.
Welcome back to Breakthrough Radio, the best of breakthrough news brought to you for 1 hour each week. I'm Sean Blackman.
Democratic Socialist Zohran Mamdani received more than 1 million votes as he won the New York City mayoral election this week. Today, we will talk about the practical implications of Mamdani's victory, how the ruling class in New York is likely to react to his election, and some of the strategic and theoretical questions for socialists as it regards elections and what political power actually means. I'm Leanne Sima Fullahan, here with Brian Becker, and this is In the News, a segment of the Socialist Program.
Leanne, Mamdani's election really was a shocker for the U.S. ruling class. People all over the country are talking about it. People who are progressive are, of course, very, very excited. As you mentioned, he got more than 1 million votes. It was the largest turnout for a mayoral election in New York City since 1969. And he got 50%, more than 50% of the vote. But it's not just people in the United States. People all over the world who are progressive, especially, are paying attention to politics in the United States, because when something really progressive takes place in the United States, the whole world takes notice, and people are hopeful because the actual restraint on progressive politics being implemented in many parts of the world are a consequence of U.S. imperialism. So to the extent that something good is happening in the United States, people care about it. You were just in Korea for political meetings, for a conference. Were people talking about it?
Actually, people were really talking about it. It was probably the question I got the most. I was meeting with different progressive and left forces in Korea who had been organizing for the past weeks and months anti-Trump protests as Trump was preparing to come to Korea for the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit. And people were really, really excited about Mamdani. It was clear that workers, students, people in the progressive movement were all following his campaign very closely. They wanted to know what the left forces in the United States think about his campaign. They wanted to know if it was feasible for him to be elected. And they really did see him as an example of the anti-Trump movement in the United States.
You know, I think it's noteworthy, and I wanted to make this point for our audience, especially in the United States, that people all around the world really pay attention when good things are happening inside the United States. By good, I mean progressive things. You and I were in Turkey not so long ago, and we met with workers. I mean, people from communities, not just organized folks or people who were in the leadership of progressive organizations, but people from unions, people from the community. This was during the encampments that were sweeping American college campuses in solidarity with the people of Gaza. The people in Turkey, the people we talked to, seemed to know more about the encampments, including like particular details at particular universities, than even we did. I mean, it was really something.
Yes, it's so true, Brian. I mean, it was really very impactful to see how much people in Turkey were paying attention to the encampments and the pro-Palestine movement in the United States. And I think the same phenomenon was happening in Korea as well. And I would say in other places across the world too. In a way, this election wasn't just a referendum for New York City, but the whole world was watching.
Yeah. As you said in the beginning, Leanne, the Mamdani election, of course, he hasn't yet become mayor. That will happen in January 2026. But it raises both practical questions: what's going to come next? What's he going to do? What are his demands? How will the ruling class react to him being mayor? But then there are historical and theoretical questions for socialists and for Marxists about what it means to have political power. Does taking office mean you have political power? We tried to address some of those questions in a statement that the Party for Socialism and Liberation, of which I'm a member and part of the Central Committee, we issued a statement shortly after the Mamdani election on Tuesday that starts to address, at least initially in a preliminary way, some of these questions. I want to share some of that with the audience. And then in response to that statement, another progressive media outlet in the Middle East actually had very, very interesting questions. So I thought maybe as a way to proceed here, we could both read a little bit of the statement, raise some of the questions that were raised to us, and then what our response is.
That sounds great. I'm going to read a little bit from the beginning of the statement, which can be found at liberationnews.org. Mamdani's campaign, which took on the character of a mass movement, energized millions across the city and the country, defied the odds, and has sent large sections of the ruling elite into a panic. Mamdani's victory reflects the defiant mood of millions of people in New York City and across the country who want a more combative stance against Trump, a more affordable life for the working class, and are sick and tired of the Democratic Party status quo. They want a government that meets the needs and aspirations of the working class, politicians who are ready to fight for the people, and a city where all workers can live with dignity. This is how a 34-year-old democratic socialist, hardly known by the public less than a year ago, defeated Andrew Cuomo, one of the most recognizable names in New York politics. That this breakthrough has happened in the center of global finance, in the city that has become synonymous with capitalism, is seen as a hopeful and positive development by workers all over the world who see a long-awaited wind of change from inside the U.S. empire. This week, a panicked editorial in the Washington Post called Mamdani's success, quote, a warning to business-friendly Democrats, and admitted that supporters of free markets have failed to make a strong case for capitalism. They understand correctly the real significance of Mamdani's success. It is not principally about him as an individual. Rather, his campaign reflects rising class consciousness and the fact that the capitalists have lost their political and ideological stranglehold over a whole generation, despite billionaires pouring millions into Cuomo's campaign.
I saw that Washington Post editorial. I thought it was, in a way, kind of amusing because the basic argument was that the economic system, capitalism, is working great. Everything is going great, and everybody should be very happy. And the only reason people are not happy and maybe turning against the system is that the apologists for the system or the promoters of the system are not doing a good enough job at communicating to working class people how great the system is for them. It reminded me of the basic line that Joe Biden took where he was making the argument, yeah, people are unhappy with our administration, but it's only because we haven't communicated about how wonderful we are and how, you know, life is so much better for people under the Biden administration. The problem here isn't the failure of the pro-capitalist elements to communicate. They communicate all the time. They extol the capitalist system all the time. They demonize socialism all the time. The problem isn't their failure to communicate. The problem really is that people are suffering under capitalism. Working class people are suffering. Young people have been defuturized. Huge parts of the population in the United States, especially among younger people, have turned against capitalism, not because it hasn't communicated properly, but because they actually know what it's like. They know what it means. They know how unjust, how unequal, how oppressive it is. Anyway, the Mamdani election is, Leanne, very, very exciting. People all over.
I'm going to have to end that there. Just a reminder that the views and opinions expressed on air or still those of a speaker and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT Champaign, Prairie Air Incorporated, Station Management, the Board of Directors, or the WEFT Associates. And that wraps it up here on where we're at here on WEFT 90.1 FM radio. Please continue listening and stay tuned for more programming. I'm about to play Blues Power by Coco Taylor from Blues Power Songs of Eric Clapton, House of Blues. Thank you so much for listening. Continue listening here on WEFT 90.1 FM radio. Have a good night. Thank you.